With Pat Findell, we're going to be the moderators of this afternoon's panel. It's a panel that will include four panelists, Kaffin Kelly, Himani Banerjee, Lisa Steele, and Cindy Patton. And I'd like to start off by going over some of what the procedures are for this afternoon, just to acquaint those of you who are new to the conference. It's a long panel, so all of the panelists will have about half an hour each to speak, and there will be a break after the first two people for a smoking break and a coffee break and a stretch. We appreciate that you've all come to hear what people have to say and to see, but you also want to comment and put forward some of your own ideas. So after all of the panelists have spoken, there will be an opportunity for you to speak as well. After this panel is over, there's going to be a summary discussion. And at that summary discussion, Lorna Boschman is going to present a motion which I'm sure some of you have already been talking about, which is to ask for breaking into small groups for a period so that people can speak more freely and then coming back for a wrap-up discussion. So that motion is coming this afternoon, and maybe you can think about that this afternoon to prepare for it. Well, what other procedures do I need to mention? I can go over them later on. The other thing is, if anyone's sensitive about photographers, they're all conference photographers, so you don't need to worry. Let's get started. Kaffin Kelly is one of the conference committee organizers. She's a Vancouver writer and graphic artist. Kaffin.
I would like to preface my talk with a quotation from Agnes Heller, whose essay on George Lukács and Irma Seidler I use again and again to think about sex. She writes, "Can two people arrive at understanding each other if every word and gesture between them carries significance only in and for itself? If the institutions and customs do not offer at least some basis for the interpretation of gestures and words? Or, to inquire further, is a purely unique relationship, free of all regulation, created from the void, at all possible?" I come up against that question. Is a purely unique relationship, free of all regulation, created from the void, at all possible? A question that answers itself, no. But I ask it anyways because I'm a woman who cannot bear the social consequences of being a woman in this shitty culture, who hates the way its customs and institutions infect relationships, and who doesn't always fuck by the rules. So every time I have attempted or even imagined an erotic relationship, I have come to this. Is a unique relationship possible? Can it be free of all regulation? Can we sustain our passion and pleasure in spite of all the institutions and customs that have damaged us and will go on hurting? Can we arrive at understanding each other again and again while the world around us twists our words and mutilates our gestures? Can we fuck and live at the same time? Once I fucked someone so beautiful, I could scarcely look. Once I fucked someone so tender, I could scarcely breathe. Once I fucked someone so intricate, I could scarcely stop. Sometimes now I almost want to forget what it is to be embraced, or find myself in the surrendered skin and fractured bones of wanting. Now I don't fuck anymore. But it's not because I especially believe in celibacy. If I personally reject the possibility of erotic relationships, it's more or less because no one can fuck forever. And before and after, there is the shame and confusion of the social relationship. And in the social relationship, gender and desire are delineated by harsh words and harsher silences, by 1,000 prohibitions and permissions, designations of difference and indifference, monstrous lies and more monstrous truths, what I call the writing on sex. Ulrike Meinhof said this culture burns fright into everyone's flesh. I think that's right, and maybe especially into every woman's sex. We get scared and scarred and incised by the social and symbolic order that designates gender and regulates desire. And we get burned by the entire arena of punishment that is or can be inflicted. Like most women, I've been raped. I've fucked for food and money and shelter. I've felt ashamed of my passion and been criticized for my frigidity. I've been scared thinking I didn't know how to fuck, and I've been scared thinking I knew too much. I've been hated and punished for my sexual choices. I've hurt other people, and I've frightened myself. I've been injured by people I love and by people I hate, by strangers and doctors and cops and every person and thing that has touched my cunt without tenderness. These memories, inhibitions, humiliations, terrors are burnt into my flesh. Anyone who touches me has to contend with them. And when I want someone, I want them by way of an impossible demand that they should heal these wounds. And it has happened. Sometimes in one another's arms, it has seemed possible to believe that desire might exceed and transgress and otherwise set up a struggle with the deathly shit of the world we live in. I have felt touched in those hurting secret places. They have been permitted and forgiven. And I've felt my flesh and blood change into something more than this compilation of scar tissue. All through the night, I've been capable of joy. It seems to me that this erotic moment profoundly engages our human capacity. We can become courageous, compassionate, fierce, tender, somewhere before or after the horror of social life, where words and gestures find reference only in each other's words and gestures, and they are the words of recovering each other's individuality, the gestures of recovering each other's substance. When it's not necessary or possible to seek significance in customs and institutions, where there is a private language and two people make a world. But no one can fuck forever. I know that erotic moment is possible. What I don't believe is that an erotic relationship is possible, because two people don't, in fact, make a world, because you don't fuck forever. Because the excess and compassion of an erotic moment doesn't bear translating to the everyday. And the collapse of erotic possibility in the hard give and take of a relationship carves new incisions which make living unbearable. But still, I want my knowledge of that capacity and that pleasure to characterize my hatred of this uninhabitable world. I figure that what's written on sex has always to be some combination of laws and passions that are or come to be inscribed on the body, burnt into flesh by language and experience. And we approach speech and silence with these wounds. When I was in the midst of the personal crises that brought me to this subject matter, I started a series of self-portraits. I don't want to burden the pictures with everything I say, but I'll just talk about how I felt and what I thought about while I drew them. These two up here I call the rejection drawings. I was separating from my lover, a long, long, relentless parting, and I was terrified, up against something like what Adrienne Rich describes in her notes on lying. She writes, "When we discover that someone we trusted can be trusted no longer, it forces us to re-examine the universe, For a while we are thrust back onto some bleak jutting ledge in a dark pierced by sheets of fire swept by rain, in a world before kinship or naming or tenderness exist. We are brought close to formlessness. Rich describes getting there by the lies of her beloved. I got there by my own lies. There were the usual deceits and betrayals that come and go in intimate relationships, but my most unpardonable secret was a collapsing universe of value. I had contrived a world of meaning with great tenderness where I could love, honor, and obey. And I had used my femininity, my vulnerability, the thousand wounds of my life story to make up words and gestures, lying words and lying gestures that would let me love and be beloved in this relationship. For years and years, I had trusted in this identity and these values. Now I found myself disbelieving them. But the lies were also a cleaving to the truth of my feelings of helplessness and incapacity, my passion to care for and be taken care of, my sense that I was nothing but the evaluation composed in intimate relationships. My rejection of this world felt physical and involuntary, like rejecting my own heart or my own artificial heart. Like being born and dying into a world before kinship or naming or tenderness exist, a world before speaking is possible. I was opening up into emptiness, and it was all also about desire, the great glittering gooey wound of my sex and my sexuality. At the same time as I was rejecting and being rejected by a lover with whom I felt circumscribed by my tenderness, vulnerability, and helplessness, I became capable of acknowledging how much I wanted those feelings erotically. I felt passionate and by way of passivity, vertiginous desire without aim or object, impossible pleasure of surrendered skin. Maybe because I no longer wanted any one thing, like a relationship or a value or an identity, I could want everything, like kissing and fucking endlessly and forever. I was all reckless and ungathered. There were scarcely edges to my body. Sometimes I felt myself as nothing but this wanting, an open mouth waiting to be kissed, a cunt waiting to be fucked. From this prone position of improbable openness, my lover's withdrawal peeled away my skin, tore out my cunt, left my bruised mouth incapable of speaking. I have this rather awkward way of showing my work, but it's better than the slides. These two drawings I call Division Parting. I'm still enraptured in a kind of nonsense of sensuality, and being separated, alone, ungiven and unforgiven, I suddenly come up with so many memories. It's like everything happens to me forever and nothing makes sense in the present tense. There is the unendurable grief of parting. I feel like I don't know how to live anymore, and I don't. What was unendurable for me was not the ending of the relationship, or at least I felt as if I had already come through that sorrow. It was more the erotic rejection, the refusal of skin and lips and that secret hidden part of me I had dared to show my lover in sex, as if all that was rich and strange and true and terrible was concentrated in my cunt, and my cunt was nothing but an open wound, opened and reopened by desire. In this welter of memory and grieving, I started working on some childhood drawings as an approach to language. Because I had to learn to speak, I was thinking about what it was like to learn to speak as a little girl, or learning not to speak and learning to lie, what I was persuaded to think and permitted to say, what was always prohibited from language, how I learned the virtue in silence, and how the terror of all the things that couldn't be talked about nevertheless got written on my gender and my desire. I figure that learning to be a little girl, learning how to become a woman, has so much to do with learning a relationship with language. We learn a system of meaning and expression where our feelings, our sex, our sexuality stays unspoken, is made intelligible as what it is not. We're instructed never to want to be independent, self-sufficient, desiring, and never to aspire to that magic circle of great men who invent and reinvent the social and symbolic order. We learn the ABCs of virtue and vice and sugar and spice, submission, denial, rape, chastity, love, devotion, surrender, in a language that disavows all the rich and strange dimensions of our bodies and our desires. Having a cunt is having less than zero, more like having a big ugly hole that we'd better wrap up and disguise. Following Luce Irigaray, the French psychoanalyst, I mention that Freud says, women have never invented anything but weaving, and weaving is only an imitation of nature, who mercifully covers our cunts with hair to shield the little boys from the horrible fact of our castration. So we learn to weave, to cover up and gloss over the big zero of our sex and our sexuality with veils and nets and jewels and sequins. We are offered one way to contrive a value in the trade that organizes patriarchal society, and that is through femininity, the whole complex of lying words and lying gestures that is produced as a form and language for women's desire. In the patriarchal economy, our passion is to be for passivity, to want to be desired as an object. I wanted these drawings to be profoundly feminine, and I filled them with all the pretty things we can use to compose our disguises. My femininity is no longer anything I can use or even bear to have acknowledged in a social relationship, because there it's a weakness, a way of accommodating and propping up the existing order of things. But I can't peel away these layers of artifice and come up with anything more real or essential. Finally, I find myself described by the elaborated surfaces and disguised interiors. They are still at least an aspect of my passion and my power. I think women can be profoundly superficial, mutable, multiple in their femininity, because that's where we change our shame and dread of this death culture into a capacity for artifice and imaginative contrivance, where we're not afraid of surrendering and recontriving the edges of our identities. Femininity is always also about our capacity for disbelieving the imperatives of the social and symbolic order, for fooling it or stealing value from it or rejecting it utterly. And I want to reject it utterly. Even when I'm a little girl, I hate the prohibitions and permissions. I hate the daily violence that marks and remarks my sexual identity. And the opposition between my gender and my desire stays unbearable. I keep wanting more and wanting differently than I am permitted to want, and I keep on becoming a woman. I came out of childhood somewhere between fear and hope. I thought maybe a passionate relationship, free of all regulation, bound only by the grace and ferocity of erotic pleasure, might rescue me from the social consequence of my femininity. But I have found these islands just as uninhabitable. For one thing, I was mistaken. Private language and private customs cannot exist. In my fiction, I have been somewhat obsessed with the failure of relationships to fulfill the promise of their erotic moment. There is the love affair, and then there are the nights and days. Each morning you go to work just like before. You live a life that has no relationship with your decision or your passion or the pleasure of each other's company. History interrupts you with death, torture, anger, impotence, sports, news, mealtimes. You eat, you argue, you lie and betray and punish and you apologize. Maybe you even say, it's not your fault, it's bigger than we are. Or, it's not you, it's everything else. And it is. And these islands are uninhabitable because loneliness, like a heartbeat, drives you mad. I understand that my sexual identity develops by a process of defeat. I want something more and other than what a woman is, what love is, what I am capable of representing as myself and my desire. And I feel like I stay unknown, unspoken, unintelligible. I don't know how to access the mediations of subjectivity and language. When I can't or don't want to lie, I can't talk at all. My cunt is written on and written over with prohibitions and permissions, but it stays indecipherable. Only in the most exorbitant moments of physical passion am I ever touched in that place without language, precedent, virtue, shame. In every other moment, my sex is hidden, has no gesture, is not communicable or apparent. I wanted to transform my capacity for passion and pleasure into a way of life, a way of contriving habitable institutions. But this capacity stayed secret. It had no language, no words or gestures. It stayed mute and indifferent to everyday life. I was in